The Final Edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for people who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
This is Barry Lank, the West Coast producer of the Final Edition, and this is another Best of the West Coast, where all our sketches come from our L.A. studios, our West Coast studios, except we will have part three of Tony Hendra's interview with Louis Lapham.
Actually, Barry, it's part two. That is, part the second. Part the third will be next week.
Who used to be editor of Harper's back when I used to read it.
I used to have a job, too.
Everybody introduce yourselves.
I'm Steve Rosenfield.
Hi, I'm Jim. At the end of the night, one of us will be dead.
I'm Abby. I have boobs.
I am Jeff Hendrick.
I am Barry Lank. I also have boobs, but it's it's not...
Not quite as sexy.
This is all scripted.
We just need a rewrite.
We have an old sketch about student shooters. It's hilarious, and we're going to do it right after the Oregon shooting.
Comedy. Tragedy plus not that much time.
But not really that much time at all. But we're finally bringing in the Hillbilly series.
All
we
right.
have Hillbilly Dentist.
I like
and
that
one of its,
lot.
One of its many, many sequels. Basically, Jim wrote this Hillbilly Dentist sketch 20 years ago, and he's been rewriting it ever since. We got Scooby-Doo. Human skin car covers. That's car covers made of human skin.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. And an appearance by Sam Waterston.
We got him?
Yeah.
He's
we got
great.
Him.
We're kind of big deal now, aren't we?
Sam Waterston.
That's at the end of the show, so you have to listen to it all the way through. And Water on Mars. We got Water on Mars. That's a thing. And this is the Final Edition Radio Hour. God, that was worse than last time.
Oh.
And last time, Steve was on the phone.
This is Western Ohio Public Radio welcoming you to the state finals for the intramural high school shooting spree.
And it's a beautiful day for it.
I'm Mark Reynolds.
I'm Lonnie Odets.
We've got kids coming in from all over Ohio, from teenagers with an obvious grudge to the real nice kids who've never been a problem.
You know, Mark, one thing you learn when you follow this competition, it's not always the quiet ones.
Nope. Some of them come right out and tell you.
Well, the school is armed, the kids are armed, it's a fair match. The ref is ready to blow the whistle, and the players are all lined up, and...
Boy, look at them rush out there.
You know, a lot of people say these shooting sprees are bad for kids, Mark, because they involve murder and usually end in suicide. But those critics ought to come down here and watch how these players really put their heart and soul into the game.
You know, at least three kids today have written their own manifesto. You show me another sport that gets a kid excited about writing.
By the way, notice the jerseys? The kids found a sponsor this year.
Yep, Ed's Pro Shop. Makers of bowling supplies, personalized trophies, and automatic weapons of all sorts.
Founded by Ed over 1 year ago.
There's Ed now.
Well, there goes another small business owner. Thanks, Obama.
So, who's ahead so far, the school or the shooters?
Well, the school doesn't know who the shooters are, so authorities are mainly shooting at each other.
And the kids are shooting everyone else.
Looks like Kevin Dreyer has broken through to the cafeteria, armed with an AK-47.
You know, that gun was donated by an alumnus of Kevin's school, by the way.
The alumni boosters really are the unsung heroes of this game.
Whoops.
Well, the last shooter has died.
Yep. But the teachers don't know it yet, and they're still shooting each other.
That counts on his score, even posthumously.
But as far as this competition goes, it's all over but the shooting.
Hey, we better sign off, because the kids sure have.
So, until next time.
Which will be soon.
This is Mark Jacobs.
And Lonnie Odets saying, stay young, die young.
So long, everybody. There is water on Mars. The Final Edition asks the man on the street, what do you think?
Has Nestle claimed it already?
You know where else there's water? Up my ass! Come back here!
What if it just turns out to be piss?
Water on Mars?
That's where I left it!
Water on Mars? Really? All right, I'll call the landlord.
I heard the EPA is already on Mars, putting up a bunch of rules and regulations.
But is there life on Kenneth Mars?
I don't care if there's water, I just hope there's scotch.
You gotta know there's some Martian fish f***ing in it.
We take you to the planet Mars, where night has fallen.
That's quite a sky up there, isn't it? All those stars...
You said it, buddy.
Makes you think about things.
Sure does. Like what?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Well, don't look at me.
I guess I just mean, when you look up at the sky, it makes you feel pretty small.
Because the sky is so big, right, yeah.
It sure is.
Also, we're microbes.
That's true. Why is it that sometimes when I look up at the stars, I'm elated, and other times I feel a tremendous emptiness?
Maybe you just need to eat something.
That's all I do.
Well, you never put on weight, so what do you care?
Do you believe in God?
No, I don't. But I am scared of the number 13.
That's just a superstition.
Exactly.
How can you not believe in God? Look at yourself. You're a huge, intricate, one-celled organism. You think anything as glorious as that just happened?
Phil, you realize that we're germs, right?
Never use that word in front of me, Doug. I told you that.
Let's talk about something else, okay? Like whether there's germs on Earth.
Why are you always so negative? Do you think this is a bad life?
I have no idea, Phil. There's absolutely nothing to compare it to.
Maybe that's exactly the point.
Let's face it, you're extremely easy to please.
Maybe you need to learn about gratitude, Doug.
I doubt it. For one thing, I'm a germ.
Doug, I just wish you could believe that you're as important a part of creation as anything else on this planet. You're as important as the rocks, the... Okay, the rocks.
I think we need to go find some women.
Great. What are those?
I have no idea.
Is that anything like bacteria?
I think it's better.
This is Politics, and this week on This is Politics, Senator Bernie Sanders reaches out for new voters, bringing his presidential campaign to a Nazi rally in Westland, Michigan.
I know that we have areas where we don't agree, such as my very existence and the existence of my family. But I also know we have areas in which we do agree, such as clean energy and the music of Richard Wagner. And maybe, just maybe, we can work on those mutual goals.
And Sanders received surprisingly warm reactions.
I would never vote for him, of course, but the Jew makes some good points.
Then it was off to a mental hospital in upstate New York where Sanders spoke to a group of drooling schizophrenics.
You believe you can explode people's faces by looking at them. I believe America's wealth gap is unsustainable. We both believe the FBI is spying on us. Let's work together.
And a quick stop at a Greek cemetery in Colma, California.
I know that most of you are dead. Most, but maybe not all. And if we pull together, we can solve the problems of this country.
Next week, Sanders spearheads a voter registration drive in North Korea.
Coming this fall, another show to make you hate being American. From the makers of Duck Dynasty comes Hillbilly Dentist.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
Hi, I'm from out of town, and I have a dental emergency. The guy at the gas station suggested I come here.
You never should have come here in these parts.
What?
I get the sawbones. Here, Zigarai, we got one!
Hi, I'm Dr. Zig. You never should have come here in these parts.
Hi, how are you?
I think I got an impacted molar. Are you sure you're a dentist? I mean, this place doesn't look fully licensed.
Frog spit. We're fully qualified for any sort of healing. Nurse Lizzie, please fetch my assistant.
Hey, get your smelly buddy in here and tell the others.
This here is my half-wit brother. He's the shame of the family and also a highly qualified dental hygienist. Say howdy, Dr. Zug.
Well, what do we got here? Looks like a city feller. You never should have come here in these parts.
Dr. Zug, may I confer with you for a spell? Hey, Zug, he ain't got no hair on his face.
I know. He ain't got no facial hair.
Now, city feller, open wide. Uh-oh. Looks like you got gingivitis.
You mean I have gum disease?
Hell no, you got gingivitis.
This has gone too far. I demand to see your boss.
You want to talk to the boss? Here, I'll go get the boss. Hi, I'm the boss. Who's been calling me?
You know, I just did.
You know better than to interrupt me during the chicken ritual.
Hey, boss.
Hi, Mom.
No, I'm your mom.
I'm leaving. You people are nothing but inbred hayseeds with no qualifications whatsoever for proper dental care.
Goose grease!
Kill them and eat them!
Whimsical little yarn if it ends there, right? But there are many more endings to choose from. Please, spin the magic wheel of endings to discover where fate can lead us. The city feller thinks he is a chair.
Sit on me! I'm a genuine Louis XIV. You don't like me because I'm made from rare Brazilian teak wood.
The gum disease joke is reversed.
Open wide, city feller. Uh-oh, looks like you got gum disease.
You mean I've got gingivitis?
Hell no, you got gum disease.
The city feller discovers he has chanced upon a rural enclave of erudite Shakespearean actors.
Our purses shall be proud, our garments poor.
For 'tis the mind that makes the body rich.
And as the sun breaks through the darkest clouds,
so honor peereth in the meanest habit.
Yeah!
The hayseeds turn out to be friendly squirrels in search of nuts.
You mean I have gum disease?
Next time, hillbilly high-yield municipal bond fund manager.
We'll be back with more of the Final Edition Radio Hour!
Yeah, the night when I came in so drunk I...
And now, more from the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Here's how to help the Final Edition Radio Hour.
My dearest iTunes comments section, I have lately returned from listening to the Final Edition podcast, and now give it 5 stars. But tell me, sweet iTunes, do you still remember our time in Venice?
Or you could do this.
Dear iTunes comments section, the Final Edition sucks. Everyone sucks. Also, I'm misspelling sucks.
If you rate our podcast or leave a comment, it helps raise our profile on iTunes. And if that sounds like we're begging for attention, it's because we literally are. We're also begging for money, but wouldn't it just be easier to pay the attention? The Final Edition Radio Hour. Review us on iTunes. Damn it.
S-U-X-S.
Today on Morning Fear, can a card game give you AIDS?
Plus, can you resist putting your tongue on an electrical coil? Our lifestyle expert says, bet you can't.
That's today on Morning Fear.
Well, I thought coming back to my place would be a little more comfortable than some crowded bar. I hope you don't think I was being too forward.
No, not at all. We've already spent so much time getting to know each other online. So, you live alone? No roommates?
No. I live alone. I haven't had roommates in a long time. It's great.
It must be nice.
You have a roommate?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like an amicable situation.
Oh, well, I suppose it could be worse, but my roommate is kind of loud, keeps weird hours, and sort of smells bad.
That sucks. Good thing we came back to my place.
Well, fortunately, I don't see him much.
Your roommate is a man?
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, you know.
Of course. I mean, yeah, he smells bad.
Yeah.
You lie, Mentor. Tell him the truth. I am your lord and master.
What was that?
Maybe the TV in the next apartment. That dinner tonight was really good. I loved the chicken. How was your salmon?
There it is again. You must be able to hear that.
Yeah, that is me. Sorry. I'm having a little gas.
She sucks my cock like a hungry little goat.
Okay, confession time here. I don't have a roommate, not really. I have it's hard to explain, but it's my incubus.
Your what?
My incubus, his name is Matthias. It's an evil male spirit that has attached itself to me and is supposed to be home right now.
Maybe we should just call it a night.
Oh, no, please. Don't let him ruin our evening. All he wants is attention. If we just ignore him, he'll probably go away.
All I want you to do is get on your knees, so I...
Whoa. Are you having sex with this thing?
Well, yes, but it's always by force, and I never enjoy it.
So he rapes you?
Yeah, but it's in his nature to do so. I mean, he is a malevolent being. Matthias can't help it.
You're defending him? I mean, it?
Matthias, he has a name. You really should try to be a little more sensitive. Just because he's the undead doesn't mean he hasn't any feelings.
Can we go home now? I need to cuddle. And then fill every hole in your body with my engorged, triple-headed, fiery penis, you devil whore.
Fiery. Well, you know, that sounds like a great idea. Why don't you two just go?
Fine, we will. But I just want to say that I am very disappointed with you. Your profile said you were open-minded, and that wasn't very evident tonight.
Yeah, and I appreciate your honesty, too, devil whore. Good night.
Well, I never... Come on, Matthias!
Huh. I thought she would never leave. You're my bitch now!
Matthias?
No!
Ah, come here, you!
No!
Oh, yeah!
Ow! Yeah, it hurts! Yeah.
Now tell me I'm pretty.
This is Barry Lank, the West Coast producer of the Final Edition Radio Hour. We're not even going to try to rationalize the premise of this sketch. What if Scooby-Doo were Hitler?
Roland, Czechoslovakia, and Russia! The ruse grabbed us in the rack. We will round them up and rend them to Ruckenwald, Auschwitz, Rittenberg, and New York.
Turns out the banking conspiracy was old man Juicestein all along.
Rusty Rowan's running after Olympics. Ruddy's a regro.
Mein Führer, we must prepare for D-Day.
D-Day?
No, D-Day.
D-Day?
No, D-Day.
D-Day!
D-Day!
Mein Führer, the enemy is headed for Berlin. Und Steiner could not stop the Soviets.
Ruckroll.
This is Food Beat, where we patrol the latest in food. This week, two glasses, one fork, and one plate in West Los Angeles.
I'm here at Two Glasses, One Fork, and One Plate on La Cienega with the owner, Ronnie Mason. Ronnie, this place used to be called Three Plates because you only had three plates, then two plates when you broke one, then two forks. So I guess you only have two glasses, one fork, and one plate. How's business?
Why do you come here? To remind me of my failures.
I'm sorry.
Just finish your goddamn omelet!
Okay.
Why do I always have to wait for the plate?
It's okay. Here, just take the plate. I'm done anyway.
Hey! Ronnie! Go go change your side again!
Shut your head hole! You hideous pig woman! If this restaurant still had a knife, I would kill all of you!
That's two glasses, one fork, and no plates on La Cienega. And this is Food Beat.
We're thinking of opening a second restaurant on Pico.
Welcome back to Haywood Public Radio. This week, Sweden devalued its dollar and NASA may have detected signs of water on Mars. Today we're asking, what do these stories mean to women and minorities? Joining me now is Nanook Hershowitz, host of our network's oldest show, All Up Inuit Your Face. Nanook, welcome.
Great to be here.
I guess you're qualified to speak on the topic of minorities because you yourself are half-Jewish and half-Eskimo.
Well, that's correct. My show is about the issues affecting the half-Jewish, half-Eskimo population.
And congratulations for keeping that going for 16 long years. What are some of the issues you explore about being half-Jewish, half-Eskimo?
Well, we can rub noses from across the street.
Interesting point.
My igloo has condo fees.
I would imagine.
When we trade wives, I get nagged by a different person.
Fascinating.
It's rough, I tell you.
And what's your take about water on Mars and people who are half-Jewish, half-Eskimo?
Well, when you think about water on Mars, we've got half-Jewish, half-Eskimo people right here on Earth.
Yeah?
About 30 of us.
Also joining me is Sharon Caleb, who is female. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right, Ron.
Sharon, the Swedish dollar is the subject of some controversy. What about women?
Well, I find it strange that the Swedes devalued the dollar without addressing gender at all. Women are half the world's population, including half the people who spend Swedish money.
Which raises another question for both of you. A new study shows that inflammatory bowel disease can be cured with fecal transplant. What does this say about the status of women and people of color?
Well, you wouldn't know it to read the story, but half the fecal material in the world is produced by women.
Slightly more than half.
Yes.
Nanook, your thoughts?
Well, I'm half Jewish and half Eskimo, so I tried dog sledding with a schnauzer.
Excellent points from both of you, and thank you both for joining me on the show today. Coming up, the NFL may change its rules on eligibility. What about autism? Professor Lank?
Yes, Dean Stanton. What a surprise.
You're really at the end of your rope this time, mister. You've had years to prove your stupid ideas, and so far I've seen no substantial results. You've exhausted your grant money, and the board and I feel we have no choice but to terminate you from the faculty. However, if you do come through for the university tomorrow night, there may be a future for you. But frankly, boy wonder, I doubt that'll happen. Good day to you.
All right, you morons. Did you hear that? It's now or never. Do you realize graduation is tomorrow and you still haven't gotten through the first page of Waiting for Godot? We've spent an eternity on this. What the hell is the matter with you?
Well, Professor, I don't think that's very fair. You know, this is the Alzheimer's Actors Workshop.
Great, great. You know what? I really don't care, Curtis. Am I going to have to hold you back another year?
What?
I wasn't talking to you, Marty. Why do you always say what when I'm talking to someone else? Why?
Because I have Alzheimer's?
What'd you just say?
I don't know anymore.
I thought so. Okay, now look, let's take it from Estragon's line, me too. Curtis.
Me too.
Together again at last. We'll have to celebrate this. But how? Get up till I embrace you.
Not now. Not now.
May one inquire where His Highness spent the night?
In a ditch.
A ditch? Where?
Over there.
And did they beat you?
Did who beat me? Where am I?
Who are you? What's my name?
God damn it! Cut! This is impossible! I'm gonna lose my tenure!
We're sorry, Professor. You did your best, didn't he, Marty?
Yes. It's too much for one man. On the other hand, what's the good of losing heart now? That's what I say. We should have thought of it a million years ago, in the 90s.
Stop blathering, and help me off with this bloody thing.
Hand in hand from the top of the Eiffel Tower, among the first.
Yes, yes. Keep going, guys.
We were respectable in those days. What are you doing?
Okay, this is great. Don't stop.
Taking off my boot. Did that never happen to you?
Boots must be taken off every day. I'm tired of telling you that. Why don't you listen to me?
Yes, yes. Perfect. You guys are on a roll.
Help me.
And did they beat you?
Who am I?
Cut! God damn it! Who am I? That doesn't even make any sense!
But I don't know who I am.
You're my mother.
Shut up. You are not his mother.
Help me.
And did they beat you?
Who am I?
You're his mother. Oh, don't!
The UCLA School of Theater. Don't let your dream of starting an acting career die with your mind. Come join us in creating what's next. The future is you.
Who I am.
You're my mother.
You are not his mother. He's not your mother.
Help me.
The UCLA School of Theater. Not responsible for the bacteria left on the endoscope tube.
We'll be right back with War of the Rhino Rishon Radio Hour.
Hi, welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour. I'm Tony Hendra. This week we're presenting part two of my interview with the legendary editor and essayist Lewis Lapham, in which we discuss various aspects of classic satire from George Carlin to Juvenal. I will let the interview speak for itself. At the moment, we are discussing Henry Kissinger and how best to treat him satirically.
It's much more devastating, I think, if you can approach Kissinger along those kinds of lines than if to call him a war criminal, because a war criminal, although true, is become such a cliched term.
Right.
And it's been used so loosely by people on both sides of the, you know, Republican-Democratic divide, that it's lost its force. We take war criminals seriously. The thing to do with somebody like Kissinger is to make him clearly a fool. And there's a lot of evidence.
More a flunky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, the diminution of people is something that great satirists have always done.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a basic technique of satire, is to call, yeah, as you said. I mean,
And that's not snark demeaning. It's just putting it in a perspective that holds it's the emperor's new clothes. It's that kind of approach.
Right. You actually quote this from his autobiography. What a king must suffer, for he knows deep down in his heart that he's a poor, cheap, wormy thing like the rest of us. A sarcasm.
Yeah. I mean, anybody with any degree of self-knowledge would know that.
Right.
But we, as a society, we flee from that kind of self-knowledge. We do everything we can not to be alone, but to be constantly on the cell phone, constantly absorbed, constantly distracted.
But we also want to be fulfilled, don't we, and empowered, and all these impossible words that mean really nothing except I want to be happier than I am right now.
Well, yeah, but that's something that if I don't mind saying so, that is your problem. It is, of course, a problem that the advertising, the product people try to do for you, try to present you with. You can outsource your life to experts who will provide the proper accessories and put you through the correct routines and keep your mind on process and, God's sake, away from any night alone with your own thoughts.
Sure, sure. And provide you with opinions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So one thing that you said reading Twain's autobiography is to be reminded that in one way or another, the American is an improvisation, the character in a play of his or her own invention, hoping that the audience, fortunately consisting of actors as makeshift as oneself, will accept the performance as par.
Right.
I mean, that seems to me both a brilliant insight into Twain, but also suggests it may just be my hang-up with improvisation as a way to get at the truth, but it seems to me that that's part of the makeup of Twain and part of what he handed down to those who came after him.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, his life is a wonderful adventure and a constant improvisation. I mean, he starts as a youth, in a small town in Missouri on the Mississippi River, goes away to Philadelphia when he's still in his early teens and learns the work of a printer in a Philadelphia print shop, comes back to Mississippi, goes into becomes a steamboat pilot. From his experience as a steamboat pilot, gives himself the pseudonym Mark Twain, And then comes the Civil War, and he has no truck with the Civil War. He's not going to fight on the Confederate side, nor is he going to fight on the Union side. So he goes to California and goes through the experience of the silver mines in Nevada, becomes a newspaper writer both in Virginia City and in San Francisco. And he's always learning things firsthand, and he's not reading travel books.
You actually say here that he conversed with murderers and harlots. He learned the commonplaces of lust and corruption, violence and subornation and cruelty.
Yeah.
A mise-en-scene in which a man who didn't see clearly didn't live long enough to hear the punchline.
That's true, yeah.
Which is certainly, you're not dealing with a version, someone else's version of these experiences.
No.
Or a camera's version.
And Twain continues all through his life. I mean, he's, again, as a lecturer, he improvises on stage. I mean, he doesn't, I'm sure he has some canned speech that he knows he's going to give, but he also can shift it to circumstances and depends on the size of the room, the mood of the audience, he's always prepared to make it up. He traveled to Europe something like 80 times. I mean, he's constantly curious and he's constantly learning. He speaks, he learns languages. He learns to converse in Italian, also in German. And he reads in those languages as well as in English. He has an enormous circle of acquaintance. He probably saw more of America, of 19th century America, than any other author of his generation. Not only saw more of the country, but knew more different kinds of people, not only the murderers and harlots in Nevada, but also a friend of John Hay, a friend of robber barons in Wall Street, friend of, not necessarily friend, but acquainted with Teddy Roosevelt. He was a man who touched the society at many of its surfaces. That's another thing that gives him the strength of his writing, because it's grounded in what he himself has seen and thought and maybe understood.
Yes, well, I mean, you make the point that Twain's understanding of the Constitution is not that it exists for the ambition of the state. I think you say that
yeah.
it exists for the
yeah.
for the independence of the individual.
Right.
And that Twain was mostly interested in his fellow citizens as citizens.
Yes.
Members of that body politic that ought
yes.
to be.
Right. Not yeah. because, one doesn't love one's fellow citizens because they're rich or famous, but because they are one's fellow citizens. And he actually understood that. I mean, he would have that same feeling. In the citizenship would be the President of the United States as well as the two-bit gambler. And
yeah, one of the, actually mentioning, I love that thing about Roosevelt, where Teddy Roosevelt, there was this horrible massacre in the Philippines
yeah.
of the Moros, where they were trapped in a crater.
They were trapped in the crater of a volcano, and right. the American military moved up. And within the crater, there were maybe 400 or 500 natives armed with a few of them, the men, women, and children, the men armed with machete knives. And but the American military situated itself around the overhanging edge of the cup and just shot them all with Gatling guns and rifles, murdered every single one of them. And for this magnificent show of military prowess, Roosevelt sent a telegram of congratulations to, I believe the man's name was General Leonard Wood,
right.
after whom there is still an important military base named, somewhere in, I can't remember whether it's in Arizona or in Florida, but Twain was just appalled at that message.
He describes the president's joy over the splendid achievement of his fragrant pet, right. General Wood.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's where I, borrowed the phrase to
yeah.
fragrant pet Petraeus. I mean, our military commanders, and I don't wish to disappoint you, Tony, but they're pretty third rate. And have
I've always thought they were first rate. It's always been my conviction that they're really the top of the line.
They're not. And this is usually true at the beginning of any war. I mean, the people who were in command of the American Army going into World War II were, by and large, incompetent. And finally, you get some good line officers that come up through the ranks as NCOs or majors and show them, prove their worth on under fire. Same thing happened in the Civil War. I mean, the first five generals that Lincoln has leading the Army of the Potomac are popinjays, incompetents of one kind or another, and then Grant appears out of the swamps in Shiloh. And the other thing is, you know, we constantly talk about the magnificence of the American military, and American Army hasn't won a war since 1945.
And it arrived late.
Yeah, but again, I mean, the advertising is pretty.
Right.
But the advertising, of course, is in order to sell, in order to prosper the defense industry. We keep spending more and more money on weapons and on our military that is proven. Our military really is advertising. I mean, it's supposed to be, there it is. You see the carriers sailing into the ports in the Mediterranean or the Red Sea, and that's supposed to be enough to deter prospective enemies. The historian A.J.P. Taylor, marvelous British historian, wrote wonderful books about...
Yeah, I attended his classes at Cambridge.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, he once said, the secret of being a great power, or of remaining a great power, is never to try to use the great power.
Right.
And every time we try to use it, it's just an embarrassment.
Yes, we get bogged down.
I mean, the invasion of Iraq after the Trade Towers was... The people in Washington were talking about the demonstration effect. That was one of their favorite phrases, forward deterrence, and we will show the world that we are invincible. That was the whole, that was one of the lines of reasoning for the invasion in the Pentagon. And of course, what they managed to do is prove the exact opposite.
Yeah.
You know, that's a misuse of one's military.
Yes, indeed. One of the things that I wanted to bring up, you make the parallel quite often in talking about Twain between his Gilded Age, which was a phrase he actually invented, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And our own. It's like a favorite theme of yours. One of the things that I've noticed in your writing, especially in the Bush years, in Harper's, was that you frequently dropped into, well, I wouldn't say dropped into, but you frequently wrote in a manner which was not unlike Twain's in terms of being a commentator of great depth and flourish, with the sort of memorable phrases. And one particular article which I dug up was a notebook, which was a front of the book feature of Harper's Magazine, and still is, I guess, which was entitled When in Rome. And it was written in January 2003, before Iraq had become the swamp that it later did. But the premise of the piece was that the Bush administration had, like other administrations, the Kennedy administration, for example, had started thinking of itself as Roman, and that you welcomed this, but you found it wanting in certain rather crucial areas. I found that to be splendid in many ways, but not the least because it was almost a Roman piece of satire. It was like a juvenile kind of level piece of analysis of the pretensions of these idiots. I mean, do you yourself, when you write in that mode, do you see yourself as a satirist in that same grand tradition?
Yes, sometimes I do. I mean, I'm a reader of Twain. I like to read Juvenal. I like to read Bierce.
And Mencken?
And Mencken and Mr. Dooley. Quite a number of them. I mean, Swift, Shakespeare is wonderful in that vein when he wants to be. So I don't do it consciously. A lot depends on, of course, what you read. My writing has never gathered much notice from the literary establishment in New York or in Washington. But,
right.
But that's because I think I'm working in a different tradition. I'm not reading the same things that they're reading. I sometimes think that the columnists of the New York Times only read the Atlantic magazine and their own paper.
Right, exactly, absolutely. So. I mean, I'm frustrated by this too. I was frustrated with Carlin, working with Carlin, because I regarded him as a major, major figure. And it was impossible to convince any of the coterie that you're describing of that fact. I mean, even though you could see in his work that it not only was it popular, but it was immensely influential. And it had all the right elements to convince people. And it rounds back to that thing of sort of trying to reduce dangerous satire or dangerous satirists to, as you say, an after-dinner speaker. And there was a rather wonderful quote. This is from David Brooks.
Right.
And David Brooks wrote a piece titled "I Am Not Charlie Hebdo," to which one answers, "You are certainly not." But one of the analyses he has in here is that most of us don't actually engage in the sort of deliberately offensive humor that newspaper, meaning Charlie Hebdo, specializes in. We might have started out that way, he says. When you're 13, it seems daring and provocative to épater la bourgeoisie, which was a phrase invented, I believe, by Baudelaire when he was in his 20s, hardly a child. To stick a finger in the eye of authority, to ridicule other people's religious beliefs. But after a while, that seems puerile. And I'm reminded of a word that was constantly applied to the National Lampoon, that the stronger its satire got and the deeper it went, it was always described as sophomoric. We were constantly described as sophomoric. And Michael O'Donoghue, one of my co-editors there, once said that sophomoric is liberal for funny. Again, it's this diminution of anything that disturbs people to the point where they're having to confront their own prejudices or they're having to confront their own beliefs in a chimera. So he goes on to say, in most societies, this is wonderful, in most societies there's the adults table and there's the kids table. The people who read Le Monde, or the establishment organs, are at the adults table. The jesters, the holy fools, and people like Ann Coulter and Bill Maher are at the kids table. They're not granted complete respectability, but they are heard because in their unguided missile manner, they sometimes say necessary things that no one else is saying. I mean, to separate, I don't know, Mel Brooks, Lenny Bruce, Ambrose Bierce, and put them all at the kids' table, and Robert Benchley sits at the kids' table. I mean, come on. It's just an extraordinary reflex they have, which seems to want to take the teeth out of what you write, what I write, what, what Twain wrote.
Yeah, they are. And the adults table, that's because they spend so much of their time in the company of the good and the great, right? I mean, they interview President Obama. They go to dinner in Washington with Senator Kerry. They can't get any distance on the people they're writing about because they want to be thought of or think of themselves as part of the establishment, among themselves, among the good and the great. And when you want to belong to the club, then you have good table manners. You know, you speak politely to the waiters and you ask your dinner companion, who's presumably the chairman of a bank, you know.
Or the Secretary of the Treasury.
Secretary of the Treasury, whether he had a good day on the golf course. And he's a nice man. I mean, he presumably loves his wife. He doesn't throw himself out of windows. I actually remember Brooks writing a column once about that, about how unfair it was to pick on politicians because in private they were really such nice people. And that's probably true, but so what? The point is, what's important is their function in public. But the David Brookses of the world want to be part of the inner circle. They want to be the most pathetic, if you haven't read it, is a column I once wrote about the passing of Tim Russert. It was 2 days of mourning on the networks. Constantly, people were showing up. Tom Brokaw, I mean, everybody that, you know, was anybody in television news stopped by to shed a tear. And the letters of congratulation from people like, I don't know, secretaries of state and presidents of foreign countries and Bruce Springsteen and so forth and so on. And it was sickening because, you know, everybody's saying this is the greatest journalist of our time, and he was not. He might have been a nice man, but he never asked a hard question. He was there to facilitate the voice of power. He was not there to speak truth to power. He was there to pass along the wisdom of power to the American people. And that's what...
And perhaps to suggest some fine-tuning every now and then.
Yeah. Occasionally, essentially, he just was pouring butter on everybody's head. But occasionally he'd add a little salt to the butter. That was his recipe.
God. Hey, Zug, guess what?
There's more coming up on the Final Edition Radio Hour?
No. Huh? You never should have come around this part.
As you know, Islam forbids images of the Prophet Muhammad, mainly because he's plus-sized and is self-conscious about his ample buttocks. But nothing forbids us from broadcasting his voice. We take you now to the Prophet Muhammad at a press conference in Mecca. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. At a press conference at a Dave & Buster's in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Prophet Muhammad, welcome.
Oh, my God! Thank
you. I am so excited. Have you seen my shoes? Aren't they totes adorbs?
Prophet Muhammad, what is your opinion of the
recent... Hang on. I just want to give a shout out to the guys at Table 17. Hi. Thanks for the buffalo wings. Yay! They were awesome.
What is your opinion of the attack on the magazine Charlie Hebdo?
I told them not to run pictures of me. They totally got the hat wrong. And the mustache? God, my Twitter feed is like totally blowing up.
Maybe blowing up is the wrong word.
Jesus H. Christ! It's my friend, Jesus H. Christ!
Is that really Jesus?
Hi, Muhammad. What's all this sturm und drang here?
We just wanted to talk about the shooting at Charlie Hebdo.
I thought usually humor weeklies were killed by the internet. Mm-mm-hmm. No, I didn't.
Nuh-uh, too soon!
Wait, is that Moses?
Yes!
Moses, what do you think of the attack on the Parisian satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo?
They did what?
Make it work.
Paris, c'est une blonde. Paris.
Man on the street!
Martin Shkreli became the new most hated man on the internet after trying to raise the price of a life-saving drug, Daraprim, by 5,000%. The final edition asked the man on the street, what do you think?
Hey, that guy sounds like he's the pill.
Well, that's nothing. I just bought the rice to Dr. Gerton's nerve syrup and jacked up the price 2 bits.
You monster!
I think really deep down inside, he just wants a hug.
I think deep down inside, he wants $1 billion.
And a hug.
Leave Martin alone!
That Martin Shkreli looks like every kid in high school who used to try to jack up the pill from $13 to $750.
If you don't like it, why don't you move to Denmark, where everyone's happy?
As long as he's not raising the price of date rape drugs.
I just want to punch Martin Shkreli in the face. I don't have a joke for this.
Good evening, I'm Wink Marigold, and this is Mouth Parade, the show where people say pretty much the same things everybody else is saying on shows, much like this one. Tonight, my guest is Vance Dugan. Welcome to the show, Vance.
Thank you for having me, Wink.
Vance, you've just written a book. Tell us about that experience.
So recently I was involved in an extremely compelling personal crisis, and I decided to write a book about it.
And why was this personal crisis so compelling, Vance?
What made it so compelling, Wink, was that it happened to me.
What's the name of the book, Vance?
It's called The Vance Dugan Crisis, though it could apply to anybody. But it was easier for me to relate to it by naming the crisis after myself.
Now, in this book, you talk about some pretty personal stuff, don't you?
That's right, Wink. I don't believe in keeping secrets. If it makes me feel better to tell somebody something, I don't care how embarrassing it is, I'll say it.
You're very forthright.
Thank you, Wink. That's a terrible haircut.
Okay. Well, I thought you meant secrets about yourself.
Oh, no. I would never divulge anything embarrassing about myself. I can't handle criticism.
Getting back to the book. This crisis, this...
Vance Dugan crisis, yes.
You say it affected you deeply. It affected your family. If you could walk us through that, what did that feel like?
That was such a key thing for me, Wink, because not only did this crisis affect me, it also affected my daughter. And anybody that's ever had something happen that affects their daughter, you know what that feels like.
When something affects you, it affects your family too, which in turn affects you.
And vice versa.
Did your friends tell you not to write the book?
No, but you know what? I thought a lot about not writing it. And then I decided not to.
That's fascinating, because I can tell you from my own experience, I have not written about 15 books. I don't know what it is. I start writing, and if I get stuck once, forget it. I'm watching YouTube and eating frosting out of a can.
Well, speaking of that, Wink, you should drop at least 30 pounds. I mean it. But there were times when I was writing the book that I got a little emotional thinking about my emotions, and I said to myself, am I being too emotional? Even now I'm getting emotional just remembering those...
Emotions.
Exactly. And not just because I'm worried this book won't sell.
But when the issue is someone else's needs versus your needs, regardless of what your needs might be, you put those needs aside, unless your need is to put aside your needs.
And then, of course, you're not putting your needs aside at all because your needs become...
yours.
Exactly. Because my daughter is more than just my daughter. She's also a person who, in this case, was the direct result of my wife and I having sex.
I know what that's like.
But here's the thing. I thought I knew what it was going to be like when my daughter was born. Because when my daughter was born, at that very moment, when she came out of that, whatever that thing's called.
Right, yeah.
The fact is, it's difficult to describe such a profound moment because you're never prepared to see somebody's head pop out like that.
That always amazes me, that a head could fit through that.
I was still surprised, and I was extremely put off by it.
I must ask you, how is your daughter now?
Oh, she is just killing it.
Because the whole time I'm reading this book, I'm worrying, what's going to happen to Aubrey?
That's what I wanted, was for you to worry. Because at the end of the day, nothing is more important than my daughter, Aubrey.
Nothing is more important to any parent than their child.
No, I honestly believe Aubrey is more important than other children.
What did you learn from writing the book?
So when I was writing the book, I reached out to a great many people who knew things that I didn't know. Now, I knew that I knew things they didn't know, but those are mostly about, like, you know, British invasion groups.
Must have been quite a revelation to know that.
Wink, I had no idea what I didn't know until I found out. And even then, I never really knew, you know, what I hadn't known.
Well, we all need to know that, whether we know it or not.
Knowing what we need to know going forward. This is the most important issue on the planet.
That's a game changer.
I think it's more of a paradigm shift.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Vance and I are going to talk about the difference between paradigm shifts and game changers.
Did you recently get a facelift?
Today on Morning Fear, electricity doesn't work. We'll show you how you've been fooled.
Plus, your heart can give you a heart attack. We'll talk to a guy.
That's today on Morning Fear.
And now here's Sam Waterston with some important information you'll want to pay close attention to.
Hello, this is Sam Waterston for TD Ameritrade. We used to be TJ Waterhouse, and before that I was Sam Waterston for the History Channel's Time Lab 2000. But most of you may know me as Head District Attorney Jack McCoy on NBC's award-winning drama Law and Order. However, did you know my career was in serious trouble until an advantageous meeting with Robert Redford on the set of the film The Great Gatsby? The scene where I was supposed to mouth-kiss Bruce Dern was about to be filmed, and I became very self-conscious about my breath. Bobby Redford, seeing my discomfort, took me aside to offer me a mitt.
Mr. Waterston, excuse me for interrupting, but can you stick to the subject of investing?
Not only did the mint alleviate my chronic halitosis, but it also became stuck in the back of my throat, thereby facilitating the trademark speaking pattern that has propelled me to startup today. Yes, that scene was cut from the film. But to this day, I never refuse a mint, nor a deep soul kiss from Bruce Dern.
Mr. Waterston?
Remember, TD Ameritrade offers you the smart, unique, demised vision.
What?
Remember, TD Ameritrade offers you the smart, unique, demised smart investment strategy.
That was completely unintelligible.
This has been Sam Waterston for Time Lab 2000.
New on the History Channel, Hillbilly Acting Coach.
Okay, listen up, people. This week's assignment was to immerse yourself in the role of a man whose land or parts have been intruded upon by an hapless stranger. Steve, start the scene.
Hi, my car seems to be having some kind of mechanical difficulty. May I use your phone?
You never should have come around these parts.
Okay, try it again, Josh, but this time I want you to be more like... You never should have come around these parts.
You never should have come around these parts.
No, 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 no. You never should have come around these parts. Got it?
Yeah, I think so.
Great. And go.
Hi, my car seems to be having some kind of mechanical difficulty. May I use your phone?
You never should have come around these parts.
No, 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 no.
You never should have come around these parts.
No, 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 no. Watch me do it. You never should have come around these parts. All right. You never should have come around these parts. It's that simple. Act it out. Live it. Be the character. Go.
You never should have come around.
No! No! Are you deaf? Become the character. A city feller is coming round
your parts. You never should have come around.
No, 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 no.
You never should have come around.
No, no, no.
You never should have come around.
No! I swear I'm going to fuck all you in the ass one of these days.
That's Hillbilly Acting Coach.
Tired of waking up in the morning to find your Datsun B210 covered in crow shit? Well, now you can protect your investment with one of Joe's human skin car covers.
Hi, I'm Ed, CEO of Joe's Human Skin Car Covers. And when I say Joe, I of course mean me, because that's what I have to call myself when I don't want the cops to know I'm cutting up homeless guys down by the river again.
Yes, for thousands of years, people have been coming to the banks of the L.A. River, drawn by the promise of life, looking for purpose, or just in search of a safe place to sleep away from hungry animals.
And that's where Joe's Human Skin Car Covers come in. Only Joe's human skin car covers are harvested from the cadavers of free-range hobos found sleeping at passed away under the Los Feliz Bridge over the Los Angeles River.
Joe's human skin car covers, made from real human skin. Joe's human skin car covers, made from real human skin. Joe's human skin car covers, made from real human skin. Joe's human skin car covers, made from real human skin.
This vintage Chevy was all I had left of my daddy's memory. Without a Joe's human skin car cover, this precious possession would surely be lost to the elements.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like daddy is with me again, looking after his car.
Yeah, huh?
I can almost feel his presence.
Okay, don't push it.
Please tell me. I need to know.
Look, look, that's not your dad, okay? You think I'd do something like that? Come on. Pull it together. He went out for cigarettes. He'll be back, I bet. Come on, relax. I didn't do anything illegal.
Joe's Human Skin Car Covers. Ask for it by name.
Take it from me. The world is a sewer. We're all just pieces of crap stuck in the hair trap of life.
Joe's Human Skin Car Covers, made from real human skin. Joe's Human Skin Car Covers, made from real human skin. Joe's Human Skin Car Covers, made from real human skin. Joe's Human Skin Car Covers, made from real human skin.
Everybody!
Joe's Human Skin Car Covers, made from real human skin.
Joe's human skin.
Joe's human skin car covers, made from real human skin.
Joe's human skin
car covers, made from real human skin. Joe's human skin car covers.
And that has been our show. The West Coast material is written and performed by, in alphabetical order, Jim Earle, Jeff Hendrick, Barry Lank, Ebby Parker, Steve Rosenfeld, and from time to time, Kurt Weitzman. He was here for like a month. He did great stuff. He was here.
And then he left.
And then he left. It was a lot of fun.
We were promised baked goods and never got them.
No, really?
Were we?
Yeah.
Anyway, he's busy. He's making a movie with Margaret Cho. It's very very, very important.
Oh, he's so important.
That's very important. The West Coast, all the West Coast stuff is produced, directed, and edited by me, Barry Lank. Our West Coast Our West Coast engineer is John Williams. Say hi, John.
Hey, John.
There he is, John, over there. For the show overall, the audio is engineered and edited by Greggy Russ and Andrew Hammond, and the show is produced and directed by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. If you haven't seen Tony Hendra, by the way, go see that movie about National Lampoon. He's in it. And it's him. That's the guy. Have a good week! Bye, everybody!
Bye.